Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Here's what we've got in store for you this morning. At 9:30, Calvin Cutler of WCAX will check in with a State House update. At 10, we'll hear the tale of pirates sailing on Lake Champlain. True story. And we finish the morning learning about what plans Raj Bhakta has for the former campus of Green Mountain College in Pulteney. But let's begin the morning out in the forest and learn about what's in there besides all those trees. Next Wednesday, the Vermont Land Trust will be hosting an online presentation called Old Forests, Mosses, Mushrooms, and Mammals. Joining us now are the co-presenters. We have the Land Trust Director of Conservation Science, Liz Thompson. Liz, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And Bob Zeno, natural community ecologist for the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. Bob, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Rick.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests a question about what you can find in those old forests, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Liz, give us an overview of what you'll be talking about in the Old Forest webinar that you've got that you're hosting next week.
Yeah, we will be talking about old forests and starting with generally what they are, why they're important, and a couple places where you can go to see old forests in Vermont and the history of them. But we want to focus in this particular talk about things that are not the trees. So the little things like mosses and liverworts and lichens and mushrooms and the importance of those organisms in the forest, and then the wildlife that you can see in an old forest and the evidence of wildlife that you can see in an old forest. So these are things that one can easily see in the winter, and that's why we're focusing on those particular things in this talk, and this will be the first in a series of talks about old forests.
Bob, when we are discussing old forests, what exactly are we talking about? How old, what are they comprised of? What types of trees? Things like that.
It's a great question, and there's a lot of misconceptions about old forests in the Northeast. And one of the misconceptions is that old forests are characterized solely by big, majestic, cathedral-like trees. And the reality is that the forests in the Northeast are much more complex than that, and that old forests, meaning forests that are biologically mature, typically with trees older than 150 years old, many of the trees common in our forests, like eastern hemlock, can live for many hundreds of years. With those trees older than 150 years and starting to develop very complex structure, meaning that trees get old, they die, they fall down, they create this hodgepodge of very messy structure in the forest. A key way to know that you might be walking through an old forest is if you're constantly stepping over downed and decaying logs.
Hmm. Well, Bob, how prevalent are the old forests in Vermont, and where will we find them?
They're very rare in Vermont. The best estimates are that there's less than 1% of Vermont's forest as old forest. And I want to draw a distinction here that old forest is not necessarily the same as what many people refer to as old growth, meaning forest that was never harvested, cut, or cleared at any time. And we have almost no old growth in that very strict definition. But we have many forests that, though they may have past disturbances, have now reestablished that biological maturity and are continuing to develop those characteristics. One of the best places to see an old forest, albeit a small example, is at Gifford Woods State Park in Killington. You can walk on an interpretive trail right there at the entrance to the state park. I think it's very short, like a quarter of a mile. It's a very easy way to see an old forest.
Now, Liz, why is winter a good time to get out and explore these old forests?
Well, I was raised as and trained as a botanist, and so I love looking at plants and wildflowers, ferns on the forest floor. Those things are not a distraction at this time of year. That's one of the reasons that it's a good time to get out into an old forest, because some of the things that some of us tend to focus on are simply not there to see, or the remnants of them are there, but they're not in their full glory. And what is in its full glory are the other things, the mosses, for example, the little tiny things that that cling to the tree trunks and that grow on those fallen trees that Bob was just talking about. There are also fungi, mushrooms, not the tender mushrooms, but some of the more woody mushrooms are quite evident at this time of year. It's a great time of year to study them, to see them. They grow, and some of those woody mushrooms that grow on the trunks of trees are above the ground surface. So even if there's snow on the ground, the snow is not covering those things. They are there to see, and there is simply a lot of interest in the forest at this time of year. It's also a great time without leaves on the tree canopies themselves to see evidence of wildlife in the upper parts of the trees, to see just interesting structures that are important for wildlife.
Bob, let's start with mosses. Your talk is called, mosses, mushrooms, and mammals. So let's start with the first M and mosses. What kind will we find in these old forests?
The unique mosses of old forests are really there because of the very old trees, of course. And what it is that the thick bark on old trees, like sugar maple, as it gets older, and maybe many people have seen this in an old sugar bush, the bark on sugar maple becomes incredibly complex and platy and thick and almost armor-like. That bark actually creates a unique habitat that's very different than the bark of younger trees, younger trees that just have very smooth, simple bark. And because of that, the way that messy, complex bark collects water and can offer nutrients to mosses and lichens, you get different species growing on those older trees. And a good example of a moss is one called Necera. It's a very feathery moss that kind of forms out in little downward arcing sheets that you can find on these trees. And then a very distinctive lichen, a different group of species than mosses, but a lichen called lungwort or dragon skin, which looks almost exactly like you'd imagine, large, platy, bubbly or warty green surface to it that becomes very vividly bright green when it's wet and dries to a more dull, crunchy green. Those are two species that you're very likely to see in an old forest, and they're often considered somewhat imperfectly, but they're often considered indicators of old forests.
Well, Bob, up until this morning, I probably hadn't given mosses and lichens much thought. I mean, I walk through a forest, I see them, very interesting. But what is their role in these forests?
I think they're evidence of the great diversity that comes from structure in the forest. The complex structure leads to diversity. And I don't think we know exactly what the role of every organism is, but I think that there are reasons to protect all the organisms because they're part of an overall functioning ecosystem that provides, a lot of intrinsic values for the species that are there, and it also provides many ecological services to us. And the more we can do to keep all the parts, and that's the mission of the Vermont Fish and Wildlife, the conservation of all the fish, wildlife, and plants in their habitat in the state for the people of Vermont, I think the more confidence we can have that our ecological systems will continue to function and that we'll be able to reap those benefits from our forests.
And you mentioned protecting mosses and lichens. Are they quite delicate?
Individually, yes. I think they could be damaged by someone going to poke at them and explore them. But I think that there are species that if we protect their habitat, and give them that place to live, then they're likely to persist over time.
Liz, you mentioned mushrooms in the winter, not something I normally think are out there. How do they differ from what we see at other times of the year in Vermont?
Well, some of the more delicate mushrooms that you find on the forest floor that are short-lived, for example, morels, which are tasty, choice, edible mushrooms, are found on the forest floor but won't be found at this time of the year. But they're the part of the mushroom, most of the mushroom actually is underground. The part that comes up and fruits, produces spores above the ground, the thing you call a morel, is only a small part of the whole thing. And most of it is a network of what we call mycelium that is underneath the ground. And that is present all the time. Now, that's not something you're going to see in the winter. And you're not going to see that delicate morel in the winter. I did last spring see some beautiful morels in an old forest in Vermont. But what you will see at this time of year are the kinds of fungi, the mushrooms, and the term fungi is a broad term meaning a lot of different kinds of fungal organisms that include yeast, for example, but it also includes the mushrooms that we know, like the morel and like the common fly agaric, like the poisonous amanita. Fly agaric is poisonous. But also the ones that grow on the sides of trees, like the horse's hoof mushroom or the shiny hemlock mushroom. These are things that persist throughout the year because the mushrooms themselves are quite hard and woody. And there's one called artist's conch, which if you turn it over, people use it to write on, to draw pictures on, because the undersurface is smooth. There are also, there's also chaga, which is a medicinal mushroom that's well known, that grows on the sides of mostly birch trees, and that can be found at this time of year. So lots of things can be found in the forest at this time of year. Some of those are, there are lots of different kinds of mushrooms and fungi, but there are two general classes in the forest. One group are the group that, like the ones I was talking about first, the more delicate ones that have their hyphae, their underground parts are literally in the soil. And those are really, really important for nutrient uptake in trees and even communication between trees. This is a fascinating science of how these interconnections underground are incredibly enriched, that fungi are actually essential to the uptake of nutrients of trees, and their presence underground is critically important. So those are what we call mycorrhizal fungi. And then there are saprobe fungi, which are the kinds that take their nutrients from down in dead wood, and there's lots of those in the old forest that you'll see. And then there are parasitic fungi, and those are the ones that actually will kill a living tree. And those are some of the ones that, for example, like the horse's hoof fungus, that you can see at this time of year. So you can see all kinds of fungi, the ones that are decomposing the wood. And this is one of the important functions of fungi in the forest. In addition to providing this mycorrhizal network, other fungi are critically important in breaking down the wood and bringing it to the forest floor and allowing those nutrients to recycle in the ecosystem.
All right, let's take a call from Fred, who joins us from Newbury. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
When you look at the overall life of a forest, how long does it take the dominant species to overcome the pioneer species?
Bob, you want to take that one?
Does it take the
dominant
species, old forest species to overtake those species?
Yeah.
And I think it's a long process. And if you have a completely cleared forest, you'll have pioneer species like birch and aspen and pin cherry coming in, and some of those drop out relatively quickly after maybe 30 years for the pin cherry. And then some of them can persist longer, up to maybe 100 years. And that's really why 150 years starts to be that turning point in a forest's development where those later successional species are well established and not only becoming dominant, but really starting to go through their own life cycles. And there's no one point that a forest changes from any stage to another. It's all a slow transition, but it's typically, the very young forests are typically less than 15 years old. You have a very long middle-aged forest from 15 to almost 100 years, and then from 100 to 150 years, that's when a forest starts to be on that trajectory to becoming old forest.
Hmm. And Bob, the third M in your presentation is mammals. So what kind should we be on the lookout for as we go into these old forests?
Right. And one of the misconceptions about old forests is that they're a wildlife desert. And the real wildlife desert is those forests that are in that middle age stage where the trees are growing. It's the forest that most of us see around us because much of Vermont was cleared. And the forests we're typically seeing as so-called old forests may only be 60 to 100 years old. They have very little complexity and as a result, very little diversity. As the forest matures into that old forest stage, it actually becomes much richer in wildlife. And there's no species in the East that are really dependent on old forest, at least that are left in our forests now that we know of. But the species that we know tend to become more abundant in old forests because of that habitat complexity. So some things you can look for are the cavities that provide nesting sites for species like pileated woodpeckers or barred owls, or if you're near a wetland, wood ducks. Those species may not be around those cavities necessarily this time of year, but they use those and the cavities remain as evidence. You might see evidence of black bears. They're obviously in hibernation this time of year, but their bear nests in the top of American beech trees are visible, readily visible this time of year. And those aren't literal nests, but places where in the fall black bears climb the beech trees and pull in branches to get the very nutrient-rich beech nuts, energy-rich beech nuts, to eat all of those before the winter. And they'll break branches, and they create this very tight mass of broken branches that from a distance looks like a nest.
Oh, wow. I've never seen that. That would be really wild and great to capture. Liz, tracking is a great winter activity. What are good places to look for tracks of these mammals in the winter?
Well, a great place to find animal tracks is any place that has had a light dusting of snow recently. That's really the best way to find animal tracks. Perhaps 1 inch of snow, maybe 2 inches, but an inch or even less is sometimes on a crust, sometimes directly on the ground. But often if there's already a crust of snow and then you've got a little bit of a snowfall on top of that, that's a great place to wait a day or so for the animals to move around and then get out and see what's been around. And in the forest, you'll want to look near the bases of trees. You'll want to look where animals might be coming down out of a tree or from, more importantly, probably from a place underground or at the base of a tree, and look for where they're emerging from the ground. Look for their tracks there. It's a really fun activity.
And what are some of the protocols that we should follow when we want to track in the old forest?
I will leave that to Bob. Bob,
all right.
Well, I think we know that the presence of people in the woods can disturb individual wildlife, and they're doing their best to get through the winter. So it's great to go out and look at tracks. I think if you're pushing wildlife around, they're using energy, they're getting stressed, and they have some reserves to deal with that, but if they're in a place where people day after day are stressing them, that can have a significant impact on their ability to their energy reserves and making it through the winter. So I think it's a good idea always to remember that we should think about giving wildlife some space.
Yeah.
And now, should we leave our dogs at home, Bob?
Good question.
Yes, that's a very important point. Keep your dog on a leash or leave your dog at home.
All right. And Liz, next Wednesday's presentation, really just the beginning. Tell us what else you've got scheduled through this year and how people can participate for next Wednesday's webinar.
Right. We will be next Wednesday's webinar, as far as participation, this is co-hosted by Vermont Land Trust and the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. But just go to the Vermont Land website. The talk is at 7 o'clock. And you'll see the talk, and you can participate there. And then future talks will be about, the next one is going to be about places that you might not expect to be old forests when they actually are, places that don't necessarily look like old forests, places that are, as Bob said, not necessarily filled with cathedral-like trees. We're going to go to some very unusual old forests and let you visit those virtually. And then later on in the year, we'll be talking about ways you can help old forest characteristics to develop.
All right. Three virtual, three in-person summer events will be scheduled. So you can go to vlt.org to find out more and to get registered. Liz Thompson is the Vermont Land Trust Director of Conservation Science. Bob Zeno is a natural community ecologist for the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. And again, to learn more about the upcoming Old Forest webinar and to register, vlt.org. Thank you both for being on this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Take care. All right, let's take a break and go for a CBS News update. Then we'll return to talk with Calvin Cutler of WCAX about what's happening at the State House. And today at 1, it's the El Grande version of The Getaway with El Hombre de la Musica, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Each Monday through the legislative session, we'll check in with WCAX Capital Bureau Chief Calvin Cutler. He joins us now. Calvin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rick. Good morning.
All right, good morning. COVID, major talking point in Montpelier last week. First of all, Calvin, what has been decided so far about how the legislature will meet, virtually, in person, and for how long?
Yeah, as you remember, last week they made the decision to meet for the first 2 weeks of the legislative session completely virtually, doing everything online. Of course, that was last week, and so we have one more week of that to go, and they're going to make a decision later this week of what week 3, 4, and 5 should look like. Certainly, it will be driven, the decision will be driven by, what is happening with the viral load and Omicron. But really, they're taking it day by day. The Joint Rules Committee is actually meeting later today to talk about this too. So, more on this to come.
The Agency of Education made a decision on contact tracing and surveillance testing. What was that decision?
Yeah, this was some big news that came out on Friday and was first reported by 7 Days. Essentially, the Agency of Education, they're expected to announce a formal rule change early this week, maybe today or tomorrow, which will basically direct schools to stop testing and contact tracing. It would then sort of shift this responsibility to parents having to do the testing at home and take a little bit more responsibility. Now, if the kid or the student, if they test positive, the school still will inform families. But one of the big policy shifts here as well is fully vaccinated students who are determined close contacts, they won't have to quarantine. So certainly this decision or this preemptive decision, I should say, which came out on Friday, there's been a really big pushback to it from some parents and from educators as well, school districts and the state teachers union. top lawmakers in the House and the Senate. They were scheduled to hear from the Scott administration this week, just as sort of a update, you know, state of the schools, you know, how are teachers and students doing? But they're moving that up in the week, I believe it's Tuesday, just because, you know, the severity and the importance of really the discussion that's happening in schools and the high cases, all driven, of course, by the Omicron variant.
Any explanation from AOE why they want to make this change?
Yeah, I mean, so far we haven't necessarily heard directly from them, but, you know, in the memo that was sent out to school districts on Friday, really it is aimed at giving teachers and school staff more time and more resources. Right now, you know, it's with the amount of virus which is spreading within schools, you know, there are a lot of cases, and it's taking up a lot of time and resources for teachers and school staff to, number one, test kids every day, or also do the contact tracing as well. And that's taking up time and resources. And really, you know, the state says that this is just in response to Omicron, which is spreading essentially faster than we can keep up with it as well. And then, of course, you know, there's the testing aspect to it. And we're also seeing some delays in test times or the test turnaround that is happening down in the laboratory as well, just because so many states are submitting PCR tests. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this policy, what the exact details, you know, those are sort of some of the high level details, but, you know, the exact details we're going to learn more about probably today or tomorrow. But certainly, as I mentioned, you know, there's been a lot of criticism from parents and from educators at this point too, because certainly there's questions of if the responsibility is on the parent, you know, to test and to report the case. Will they do that? You know, I think there's questions to be asked there. So we'll see how it all sugars out.
And another factor, I believe, staffing both in those labs and at the schools have been impacted as well by Omicron.
Exactly. Yeah, we saw a number of closures on Thursday and Friday of last week, and even this week we're seeing school closures, you know, just because of staff members having to quarantine. And it's not just teachers, but also bus drivers and cafeteria workers and guidance counselors, really people all across the school system. And I think it's also worth pointing out, I mean, it's not just schools that are being impacted by Omicron. I mean, really, it's organizations and institutions all across the state and across the country, whether that be, you know, retail, manufacturing, education. It's all over. So again, this is just one way that, you know, the Scott administration with this new guidance is trying to give teachers, give schools the ability to kind of cope with these with the emergence of these cases.
We all may be done with COVID, but COVID's not necessarily done with us. All right, Calvin, on to a non-COVID issue. Governor Scott's administration looking to invest $200 million. So what do they want to invest in?
Yeah, this is part of what's called the budget adjustment. Without getting too far into the weeds, you know, every year the lawmakers will make a couple tweaks to the budget kind of halfway through the fiscal year. And normally it's maybe $1 to $5, maybe $10 million at the most. But this year, I mean, certainly we've had better than expected tax revenues. Plus there's federal stimulus money, which is still flowing through the economy. So the Scott administration is hoping to get a jump start on the workforce proposals that the governor outlined in his State of the State address last week. You know, just a couple of high points here. I mean, there's some $80 million for housing, you know, $30 million for health care recruitment incentives for staff and for nurses, you know, another $25 million more for step-down hospital beds, and about $50 million or so to help pay down outstanding debt on the state's part as well. You know, I think like a lot of these initiatives, I think there's going to be the devil's going to be in the details of what they'll look like and, you know, how some of these programs will work. But the Scott administration, they're really framing this $200 million investment as, you know, putting a Band-Aid on some of the most critical or the, some of the most critical needs that the state has right now in terms of our workforce and in housing as well. These are things that they say can't wait until May or June or July when the next year's budget will go into effect. So that's sort of where, at least on the money side of things, where the discussion's going to be at the State House this week. Certainly there's lots of people, even today, House Appropriations is meeting, and there's lots of organizations that will be lobbying for this money and asking lawmakers, because lots of people still are feeling the fiscal impact of the coronavirus. As you mentioned, you know, it's still affecting us whether we like it or not.
Yeah. How quickly could that money get pushed out into the state?
Yeah, this could come within the next few weeks, to be honest. I mean, tomorrow is the deadline for committees to send their recommendations to the appropriations committees. And then appropriations, they'll kind of hash out the numbers, make sure the bottom line is good. And then they'll put together a proposal and either vote on it in the House or Senate and send that to the governor. So it looks like this could looks like the legislature's really looking to fast track this one. But, you know, again, I think we may or may not see all of those components. Certainly there's, you know, broad agreement for, you know, the $80 million in housing and also, you know, the investments in the step down facilities for hospitals to help relieve the COVID load. But I think, you know, there could be some disagreement over, you know, using some of this money to pay down debt or some of the other initiatives. So I think all of that, though, those will be really robust discussions that are going to be happening this week in the legislature.
The governor's budget address still a couple weeks away. I know he doesn't like it to tip his hand, but do we have any sense yet of his priorities when he delivers that to the legislature? Do these items of this $200 million, the housing, health care, hospital beds, paying down debt, does that kind of tip us off on what we might hear in a couple weeks on his budget address?
I think so. I mean, yeah, looking at those pots of money and really kind of examining where are the Scott administration's priorities, I think we can expect to see those pots of money and those allocations just expanded onto a $7 billion state budget. You know, certainly there's going to be a lot of money for housing, a lot of money for workforce recruitment and retention. We heard, of course, the governor talk about, you know, workforce training through community college centers and other tech centers. So I think there will be some big investments there. Again, we'll have to see exactly what the numbers are going to be. But I think that's what we're going to see as a flavor of is, you know, these really big investments in housing and in workforce. But I think what's going to be really interesting and a lot of people are going to be looking for potentially is, you know, how much money still will be allocated to the COVID-19 crisis on hand, whether that be staffing in hospitals or, you know, recruitment and retention bonuses for either teachers or healthcare workers. Certainly those, you know, it's all tied to the viral load and where we are with the pandemic. And with Omicron, as you mentioned, it's changing day by day. But I think that's kind of what we can expect to see in the governor's budget address when he gives it in 2 weeks or so.
All right. Calvin Cutler is the WCAX Capital Bureau Chief. Calvin, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Look forward to talking to you again next Monday.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to wrap up a few things from last week, maybe even sneak in one of your calls. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Oh, those little ants marching. On Friday, we had a listener, Belden, from Addison County, bring up the fact that 3G cell phones will be phased out in February, making things difficult for people who can only afford the less expensive flip phones. And I didn't know about it. I was really pleased to get his call, as a matter of fact, to kind of shoot up a flare and make me do a little research. And so let me tell you what I found. This is from a site called Tom's Guide, and it was really the most comprehensive, and I hope I don't bore you too much. I got a couple pages printed out, but I'll read as much as I can. Because I think this is important. If you haven't heard this, this is almost like when the TV sets, you know, went to HD. And here we go. 3G, the wireless network, standard that ushered in the smartphone era, getting shut down in 2022 as carriers look to build up more current technologies. That means devices that still rely on 3G, and that's from smartphones to tablets to alarm systems, won't be able to connect anymore once carriers pull the plug on 3G. The good news is the shutdown has been a long time coming, giving carriers and device makers plenty of time to ensure a smooth transition. Well, you would expect the makers to say that. But here we go. All the major wireless carriers in the U.S. planning shutting down this year. AT&T is first, and that's what Belden was referring to. That's February. T-Mobile will shut down its Sprint in March and then its own T-Mobile 3G in July. Verizon gives you the longest with 3G, so if you've got a Verizon, you have till the end of the year. All right, that's what I'm finding here. Wireless phone companies that turn to the networks of larger carriers provide their coverage will lose the 3G once the parent goes down. So Cricket, for instance, they use AT&T, so that would mean in February. Couple reasons why carriers are ready to pull the plug on 3G, and the first comes down to progress. Commercial 4G networks first went live in 2009. 5G followed a decade later. Throw in 3G, that's a lot of different networks to keep up and running. So 3G connectivity uses parts of the wireless spectrum. If carriers no longer have to support their aging 3G networks, they can reallocate that spectrum to other forms of connectivity. So as we advance to 5G, they don't want to have to hang around with 3G, give space to that. What phones will be affected? Most phones released in the past few years will work just fine after 3G networks go away. The key is to have a handset that supports voice over LTE, which would certainly cover any recently released phone that has been the standard for a while. Let's see, what else we got? Still, while the number of phones affected isn't large, it's not insignificant. AT&T back in September said that 2.7% of its customers would be impacted by the 3G shutdown. With more than 195 million customers by the end of September, that would translate to around 5 million people. So as Belden was pointing out to us, there are still quite a few people who use 3G phones. Because carriers have known about this transition for a while, they've been likely to be in contact with customers whose phones will stop connecting to 3G. Biggest impact may be on low-income households, which don't have the means to upgrade to new phones at the drop of a hat. However, the Federal Communications Commission offers, listen to this, a lifeline service that provides discounts on phone service for some low-income consumers. So that was a big thing that Belden pointed out. Pay heed to that. FCC has something called the Lifeline Service, so if you're in that situation, might help you. The 3G shutdown affects more than just phones. Other devices make use of 3G connectivity as well. And let's see, those are things like I mentioned, tablets, e-readers, and some alarm systems. So, all right, and we have Sarah joining us from Duxbury now. She has some more info on 3G and 4G. Sarah, thanks for calling.
We just went through this in November with my elderly brother, who had a flip phone, a 3G maximum, and did a lot of research. He's with Verizon, so he had a little more time, but through a lot of research online and so on and so forth, and ultimately going to the Verizon store up in Berlin, we did get another flip phone, or very simple, similar phone that does offer the 4G. Perfect. And I guess the 5G change will still enable 4G.
Yep.
So I was able to, it was not easy, but I was able to research and get him, for not a major amount of money, a different phone which does accommodate the 4G. So even though his 3G phone would no longer work, apparently now with it going to 5G max, the 4G that he has now will work. So I wanted to offer hope to the gentleman who called and just say that you know, research online. The one that we went with was a company called Orbic Journey 5, and that phone does allow people to access calling.
Perfect. Sarah, thank you for that. That's great to hear. Sarah letting us know that, and I also found there are budget 4G phones, Nokia, for instance, and other makers. She mentioned Orbic, that will be available. And so the new phone that you buy has to be 4G or 5G. So the less expensive ones will be the 4G. And they're kind of like the flip phones. I think they might be start to refer to them as something like feature phones. But so pay heed to this. I'm so glad, Sarah, that you called, and also that we heard from our friend on Friday, Belden, who brought this to our attention. I had no idea. And so it's one of those things that kind of sneaks under, although, you know, maybe in tech publications, they have been talking about it, and Belden picked up on it and let us know all about it. So glad to hear that. I want to pick up this one, too. Here we go. Dwight emailed after 7 days. Publisher Paula Routley mentioned on Friday that she had a ticket to see Bob Marley years ago at Memorial Auditorium, but the show was canceled. And here's what Dwight said. He said, I had a ticket to that Bob Marley show that was canceled. It was 1981 or 80. His last show was in Pittsburgh, two stops before Burlington, and his decline in health was swift, as was mentioned. The Memorial Auditorium schedulers were able to get Jimmy Cliff on short notice, as he recalls. He said it was a good show. Of course, it wasn't Bob Marley. Dwight says, never, never let a good performance pass you by. Tell yourself, I'll catch them on the next tour. Don't do that. As much as you can, Dwight says, get out, see the bands when you can. Don't miss it, because you never know what will happen. Thanks, Dwight, for that. Great update on that. And all right, I've got one more little story I want to relate. This is supply chain problems, and this is like first world problems. So the other night I pulled out a box of Cabot bacon mac and cheese. They have three flavors. They have the regular, the bacon, and pepper jack or something. Anyway, I go to make my bacon mac and cheese. I pour in the, you know, the cheese powder packet there, and there should be little bits of bacon in there, and there is no bacon. Lost in the supply chain, my bacon mac and cheese. And, you know, at first you're a little outraged. Hey, where's my bacon? And you think, you know, in the grand scheme of things, with all the supply chain problems, me missing a few bacon flakes. Unfortunately, I didn't have my own bacon, or I would have just, you know, fried some up and threw it in. But anyway, my bacon mac and cheese was sans bacon. And, you know, what are you going to do? That's what happens in this supply chain problem era of COVID. In year number two, and boy, after March, we're clicking over to the third year of in this COVID pandemic. NBD, no big deal. I still enjoyed my mac and cheese, even though it didn't have bacon. Hey, thanks, Sarah, for your call, and Belden for getting us on that 3G question. Really interesting stuff and important to know. All right, time for a CBS News update. Then we're going to be back to learn about the Pirates of Lake Champlain. Coming up at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds, from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. You know I love hearing from you about who I should interview and about what. Well, I heard from Rick Norcross of Rick and the All-Star Ramblers last week, and He must have thought I was putting him on when I reacted so positively when he recommended that I speak with our next guest. But the story of the Pirates of Dingley Dell is one of my favorite Vermont tales. When I first learned about it several years ago, I could not stop telling people about it. Joining us now is the author of the nonfiction book, The Pirates of Dingley Dell, a true swashbuckling adventure at a Vermont boys camp, Brett Corbin. Brett, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, good morning, Rick. Thank you.
Good morning. Listeners, to ask Brett a question about these very real Lake Champlain Buccaneers, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Brett, where and what was the camp where these Pirates of Dingley Dell could be found at one time?
Well, it was on the West Shore Road of South Hero on a bay called Beach Bay. And they actually were lured there by the qualities of the bay, you know, a tranquil, peaceful area with a large bay for mooring the boat.
And when did this all exist? It was a camp, right?
Right. It was a boys' camp started in 1928. By a couple of visionaries. I guess we should mention who they were, right?
Sure.
So we had Francis Baker, who was basically an engineering student surveying the outbacks of Canada, who became very proficient at building birch bark canoes from the Native Americans. And he went on to have a whole boat-building career because he was so good at it. And he was even called upon by the military to solve any problems they needed with their Navy. And he was really an incredible guy and did a lot of things. And I'll just, it's too long a story to get too involved with, but I'll just mention that some of his miraculous feats were he developed special elevators for military aircraft so the planes could get up quickly for deployment during the war. And he developed special stages for Radio City Music Hall that had such advanced engineering that they were protected by the military because they were afraid that the technology might leak to the Germans. And he also, one of the really big thing he did was he was one of the chief engineers on the Manhattan Project developing the atomic bomb.
And this is the guy who started this camp. What was the camp called?
The camp was called Dingley Dell, or the Adventurers' Camp. Dingley Dell was actually the name of the property, and it got that name because Mrs. Baker was an avid fan of literature, and she liked Charles Dickens a lot. So Dingley Dell was a fictional Shangri-La in the Pickwick Papers that Dickens wrote, and so that's what she thought would be a good name for the camp.
And Francis had worked at another camp across the state, right? And before he opened this one.
Yeah, he worked at a camp called Camp Lonakila in Fairleigh, Vermont. And that's where he basically got his experience working with kids that were 10 to 13 years old. And they built some really amazing boats. He built a Spanish longboat with the kids, and he built a
Viking boat, a castle. Brett,
he built a castle. A multi-level castle because every summer camp, boys' camp, needs a fortress, you know, and for daily pillaging and plundering of the occupants. So the castle was kind of a place where they could stage performances and things. But the Spanish galleon that they built was kind of cool because the whole stern of it would open up, and it served as a stage for plays that Marion would often produce.
Wow. This is life before video games, life before television even. Now,
and Life magazine actually picked up on this.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, they were so enamored with what was going on there with these 10 to 13 year old boys that they visited the camp one day, and their plan was to bring an engineer over there to help explain all the things the boys had built and how they worked. But after talking with these boys, they said, you know, there's no need for an engineer. These guys know everything we could ever need to figure out.
Wow. So. To have been a kid growing up there and getting all that information at a young age, it's interesting to see where they all wound up. Now, what is your connection? You know, why are you so interested in Dingley Dell and the Adventures Camp?
Well, the camp's just down the road a ways from where I live on the West Shore Road, and I've always been attracted to that the headquarters there, the building that's near the road, because it's just so unusual looking. It looks like something right out of a fairy tale. And I just one day was I just had this mindset that I was going to figure out more about this camp, and that opened up the whole thing.
I'm so glad you did. Preserving a great slice of Vermont history. All right, 1929, first group of campers come there. So what was at the camp when that very first group of campers showed up to spend their summer at Dingley Dell?
A ragtag settler's cabin and a kind of a half of an old outer building, and that would serve as the boys' dormitory. So basically, the boys arrived there that first summer expecting to have a wonderful, tranquil summer camp experience, building, you know, sailing boats and doing other traditional camp activities. But when they got there, the skipper said, the boys asked the skipper, well, where's the camp? You know, I always see these couple old rotten buildings. What's going on here? And the skipper said, well, he said, let's get going. We've got to build the camp. So that was their summer plans changed dramatically because it was a summer filled with work, heavy duty work.
So what kind of things did they go about building?
Well, they had to transform the old settler's cabin into the headquarters of Dingley Dell, for administrative duties and for living and eating. They had the dining hall was in there, and then they had to build an assembly hall for performances. Which is a really good size building, and so that took them quite a while to do that. And then they had one of the outer buildings. They had to take the roof off and add another floor for the dormitories, and that would be their dorm.
Had a little bit of problem with bats, didn't they, at the dorms?
Yeah, you know, everything at Dingley Dell was a learning experience. The skipper really wanted to make sure that the boys learned from their lessons, and they didn't have a perfect wall-to-roof union that first year, and they were experiencing a nightly series of bat attacks, and so we had all these boys running around with baseball bats and tennis rackets trying to evade the bats. And they ended up rubbing themselves with castor oil and garlic to help deter the bats. And you can imagine that how what that smelled like around there. And I think there was a plan to their madness because adults didn't want to get anywhere near that place.
Oh, yeah, that's a good way to keep the chaperones away at night.
That's right.
Have the bats in, smell terrible. It got pretty rowdy, I would imagine, in there. Now, did they start building boats that year as well?
Yes. Yes, they did. They basically filled the shoreline with boats that first year, on the average of one a day. But that was also the year that the big thing took place, the pirate ship.
All right. Tell us about the boats they built, especially that pirate ship. That's the important one.
Oh, they built a lot of sailing craft. Which some of them are still around the premises here and there, in decayed conditions. But they built lots of sailing vessels and a few rowboats and utility boats and things of that nature. But by that middle of that first summer, you know, the skipper gets this look in his eye that the kids usually know meant trouble, and meant a lot of work for them. And he told them about this plan of his that they were going to build this huge 75-foot-long pirate ship, and they were going to actually live on it, and it would be like a mobile classroom for the kids for 1 to 2 week stays out on the lake.
Incredible. And they actually did build the pirate ship.
Yeah. And I'll give you a little of the specs on this ship because it was decent. It it was 75 feet long, and it had a 20-foot beam, and it had 22 berths in the lower deck for 33 people, sleeping capacity.
Wow.
And had a galley in the rear for, you know, for meals and things that the cook made three meals a day for the ravenous pirates. And it had a rumble seat that hung in the rear with colorful feathers. It was really quite the sight. And they had a poop deck out there, too, which is, you know, traditional pirate fare.
Yeah.
And so, as I mentioned, more than one full moon showing over Lake Champlain often. And, yeah, and it had a huge sail network, 280 square yards of fabric that Mrs. Baker made and hand-dyed herself.
Mm. Wow, what an incredible vessel. All right, Brett, so they have this pirate ship. They sail out of South Hero around Lake Champlain. How did people react when they saw a pirate ship full of young pirates on the lake?
Well, it was quite unnerving to many people, particularly the folks over at the Hotel Champlain, because they had a steamer dock over there where the, you know, the wealthy tourists would come at to go up to the hotel, and the boys loved to cruise by the Hotel Champlain and raise their Jolly Roger and then, you know, kind of turret the cannon that they had on the front of the boat around right when the guests were coming. And those the people from the city did not take that too kindly.
Good.
They were really kind of unnerved by all this.
Oh, that makes me happy. So the first book, the book came out, what, about 6 years ago? And I think you've got a new edition of the book. So what kind of stories or information have you added to the original book?
Well, there's a lot of interesting little behind-the-scenes stories that came about after the book was published. So when I do the second edition, I'm just going to mention a little bit about these fun little stories, like for instance, the mayhem at the Hotel Champlain. That one summer when the kids were giving the guests so much problem with all these scares, the management decided that to quell the boys from doing these things, they would make them an offer where they would give them one night at the hotel, free to have, you know, to roam the rooms and do whatever they wanted at the hotel for one night if they would just kind of lay off with scaring the guests. So that night was an absolute nightmare. You're talking about the switchboards lighting up like crazy, and there was no one left, no staff left to take care of any of the other guests. And they had the hot water in the whole building was emptied within the first 2 hours of the boys' stay because they were using the saunas and the bathtubs
oh my
and everything.
Goodness.
And the golf course, the world-class golf course, was you know, a time bomb out there with you know, walls going everywhere and guests ducking and trying to avoid the consequences out there. So that was quite a night. And I'd also talk about I talk about a skinny dipping raid at Lanakila that was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
when the boys built a makeshift, they found a cache of bones out in the woods, so they thought they would take all those bones and make this raft out of a barn door and some wooden logs, and they would kind of go out at night and move that raft into place in front of the girls' swimming raft. And they would shake the bones and scare the girls. And unfortunately, the camp counselor came out at that time, came down to the lake, and the boys were chased off. And as they were trying to row the boat back to the shore to get away from the counselor, who was a really good swimmer, the boat fell apart underneath them.
And
so they had to swim to shore and go through the woods, which was filled with thickets, and they got ripped to shreds doing it.
Oh.
So the next morning, you know, everybody knew who the culprits were for this raid.
Yeah, couldn't hide that. And they made a boat once of airplane parts, is that correct?
Yeah, the skipper wanted to build a boat that was just purely for fun, so he asked the folks around the towns near Lanakila if they would contribute. And so they made a boat that was a collection of car engines, airplane engines, miscellaneous parts of varying natures, and that thing was so loud when they revved it up that it vibrated everything in its path. In fact, the director talked about that he was sitting at his desk when that thing revved up, and the whole bookshelves and desks and everything in the room would slide from one end to the other. And they just decided that they couldn't run that anymore, but it was kind of a wild boat.
Do you have a ghost story, a boat ghost story to share with us?
Yeah, the kids were out in Westport, New York one night, and they ran into a lightning storm, and it was really pretty heavy duty. And out on the west, they saw a weird boat coming towards them, and they were really kind of unnerved by it because it was kind of a rudimentary fishing vessel, and it had boards that were just nailed in random positions, and it looked really creepy to them. But it was just flopping around out there, so they figured that it was probably unmanned or something happened to the people. So they figured they had to go and check it out. So the boys got over to the boat, and one of the guys got up on the stern of on the bow of the boat, and he immediately was hit by this rope that seemed to come out of nowhere and just hit him right across the face and knocked him in the water. And while another boy was investigating the sides of the boat, he found a porthole, and he opened the old hatch and hollered inside to see if anybody was there. And he didn't get any response until about his third or fourth time he hollered in. And then all of a sudden, he saw flickering lights run across the interior rooms, and a loud groaning sound coming. So quickly got his head out of there, and he got hit in the head with the door as it came back to place, and he got knocked into the water. Those two boys now were swimming towards the other side of the boat because they heard screaming from the other side, and it turned out that one of the guys had got his hand stuck on this big black mass that he was trying to investigate, and it turned out that his hand got stuck on a barb that was filled with fish and seaweed. And so the boys had to pull the barb off, his hand off the barb, and then he let out a few choice words that echoed through the night. And so all three boys were kind of unnerved by this experience, and what turned out was that they got up on deck because they heard a loud sound down on the lower quarters. And so all of the boys started to go downstairs, and they saw these flickering lights again, and they heard these loud noises from the bottom, and that's where I'm going to leave the story.
All right, good. You got to read the next edition of the book. Hey, you are working on a documentary I mentioned, so what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Stephen Bauer and I. Stephen is a career filmmaker. He made a lot of television commercials throughout his whole career, and he's also friends with the Baker family, mm-hmm. just like I was. Both our families were connected, and we decided we wanted to make a movie in the Ken Burns style of documentaries, using both of old photos and live cuts, live feeds. And we wanted to just kind of convey the feeling of the camp, how it felt to be a camper there. So we were taking viewers through the assembly hall, showing them the portraits on the wall, the oil portraits of the kids that one of the campers made from the first group of boys. And we're showing them, all the old equipment in there that the boys used, for recreation. And then we take them outside, and we go over to the old nurses' quarters, and all the little nooks and crannies where the injured, anybody that was sick would be over there at the infirmary. And then we take them to the tennis court, and then eventually, there's a big judge's bench there where Mrs. Baker ruled the tennis matches with an iron. iron rule. According to who she liked and didn't like, she officiated. And then we walked down the lake and show where the kids would have, you know, run through the woods to get to the water. And once we got down to the water's edge, we just investigated where the Aladdin was moored up onto the big rock all those winters.
And it should be noted, there are still some of the buildings. That's what you're filming. Some of the buildings that were there back in the 1920s, 1930s.
Right. We're doing the headquarters and the nurses' offices and showing the general grounds. And then we're going down to the waterfront and exploring everything that, you know, all the sites where the kids would have participated in things down there. And where the boat was moored.
Brett, when do you expect the film to be finished?
Hopefully this spring sometime.
All right. And we've got about a minute left. I understand you're working on another book. What are you working on?
Aside from the new edition of this book, I'm working on a book about the one of the Lake Champlain steamers called the Vermont II. And I'm talking about the captain meeting on that boat one day for one of his last voyages and reminiscing with dignitaries, going back in time and talking about all the events that happened on the boat.
Oh, my. All right. So the book and the movie, the documentary by Brett Corbin is The Pirates of Dingley Dell, A True Swashbuckling Adventure at a Vermont Boys Camp. And you can look for the new edition of the book and the documentary a little bit later this year. Boy, all those young pirates had to be a lot of fun. Brett, thanks so much for sharing the story of South Heroes Adventurers Camp.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to talk with Raj Bhakta about his plans for a closed college campus in Pulteney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. When news broke in 2019 that Green Mountain College would be closing, I headed to the Pulteney campus to watch and record the reaction of students, staff, and alumni at the school's last home sporting event. It was a men's basketball game, 81-53 win over Bryant-Stratton College of Buffalo in the Waldron Athletic Center, more affectionately known as the Eagle Dome. I found a quaint campus of lovely buildings and a college community of individuals who love their school. In August of 2020, the campus was auctioned off and bought by Raj Bhakta, the founder of Whistlepig Rye. And Raj Bhakta joins me now to discuss what's happening in Pulteney. Raj, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great to be here. Rick, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Raj about his plans for Green Mountain College's campus, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Raj, you've done a number of things in your life, like appeared on The Apprentice, you've run for public office. What got you into the spirits business?
Rick, I like to joke that what got me into the spirits business was like a series of spectacular errors, failures, at least as I viewed it at the time. So I was doing a hotel project, really my first business project that I did in real estate, and this was in 2003 or 2004, and I couldn't. Well, I didn't really enjoy working with my family's in the business. My family's in the hotel and real estate business, and I didn't really enjoy working with my dad. And nor was I really enjoying much living in this ski town out in Colorado called Vail. And a friend calls me up and he goes, you know, look, I know you're miserable there. I've got the solution. He goes, well, go on The Apprentice. You get your like peace with honor exit from the family business, so it's not going to look like you ran.
Right.
And you know, your social life should be on the uptick if you're on the biggest show on TV. So, you know, after a little bit of debate, I said, okay, no, I'll go do it. Sounds compelling logic. I was 28 years old. And that was one ride, and that led to another, but I didn't win, you know? So I was like, man, how do you, I can't win a TV game show. So I was a little down on myself for that. And then I ended up getting, I probably got talked into running for a race for U.S. Congress. This is in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Now I'm bringing you up to 2006. I kind of wanted to do it, though, because I always promised myself that I would run for some office by the time I was 30, and I was 29. And, you know, had a little bit of fame coming off The Apprentice.
Yep.
But bad year to be a Republican. The 2006, you know, 40 House seats lost, but I ran a great race, but I lost. And then, you know, not knowing what to do next, you know, to cap off this period of, I would call it attention deficit disorder of my life, I decided that it was a good idea to go after chasing a replacement to Steve Irwin. You remember the Crocodile Hunter guy?
I do, yeah.
So Steve Irwin just died, and I figured it would be really, really great TV if there was an Indian replacement for it. I was like, I will catch the crocodile by the tail. And I went off to India looking for his replacement, and bottom line, I couldn't find it. So now I come back home. I can't, and I'm really down. I can't win a TV game show. I can't win a congressional race. And in a country of 1.4 billion people, I can't find one guy to replace Steve Irwin. And sort of, I didn't know what to do next in life. And long story short, I ended up buying a farm in Shoreham in Vermont, Addison County, where I figured I would, you know, lick my wounds and work on my next move. But as I did that, the economy tanked. And you know, I had to make that farm work. And that's when I saw the opportunity in high-end American whiskey that originates farm to bottle, and began that in 2010. And that, thank God, worked very well.
Yeah. Whistle Pig Rye, delicious. Now, you purchased the campus of Green Mountain College in Pulteney in 2020, August of 2020. Give us an idea of what's on the campus there, Raj, that you purchased.
So it's a beautiful campus,
yeah.
Classic New England college campus, Georgian architecture, 26 buildings, 500,000 square feet. You mentioned the, you know, basketball court, swimming pool, auditorium, big, beautiful dining hall, a library that I'm sitting in right now with 100,000 books in it. You know, really a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful campus that, you know, had gone into, disuse, right? I mean, the college went out of business.
Right.
And now the idea is to, you know, bring it back to life, not just as an educational institution, but much more.
What do you call it? It's do you still refer to it as Green Mountain College? Do you have a name for it? Bakta?
No, we still call it Green Mountain College.
Nice.
That's what we call the campus.
Yeah.
But we're bringing it. I've moved my spirits business to campus here. You know, we've got 10, 15 people coming in the office every day, probably actually a little bit more right now. We've got some of the buildings occupied. We're going through the permitting process to, take the first steps to create a vision which is a school for food, beverage, and hospitality that is also backed by having world-class assets in that area's hospitality, you know, five-star hotel we're developing on campus, reusing the buildings, and in beverage, for example, I know the beverage alcohol program or business very well. We'll have a program in that area beginning this year, a small pilot program, where people will learn soup to nuts of that business beginning on the farm, which is where everything that we put in our mouth should begin. You know, we're in the initial steps of bringing to life a broad vision where this campus will be once again brimming with activity and bustle.
What's the projected timeline, Raj?
I think we'll have, presume, you know, we've got the local permitting and then Act 250. So our hope is to be able to finish that process between those two this year and have it built out within, this is the hotel side. So we should have the hotel up and running within the, I'd say, 2-3 year time frame. I'd like to do it quicker, but things are moving a little less quickly nowadays than they used to.
Yeah.
But I think the whole campus, you know, project, I said when I bought it, this is a 5-year project, and I think that that timeline holds. This summer, we should have a really cool destination experience together for people who are interested in spirits. So, Rick, I've got the largest collection of old spirits on Earth, and we're going to bring them into our library and allow people to come and taste and, you know, blend their own bottles of product. And we'll have a small wood-burning still up in operation and be able to offer an experience for people in the world of spirits like no other really in the world.
Mm. Raj, now you mentioned the oldest distilled spirits, Armagnac is what it is. Tell us what that is exactly. Until I heard you talk about it, I'm not sure I'd ever heard of it before.
So, Rick, this is the forgotten gem of the entire world of spirits. And I was amazed when I ran into this, I sought it out, this area in France where they produce in the same way that they have for the past several centuries in these wood-burning stills. The spirit itself is akin to cognac, which is much more famous. There are famous brands like Hennessy. But cognac is its much better known cousin, but it's basically made from wine. It's distilled wine. So before I did whiskey, whiskey's made from beer, any kind of grain, corn, wheat, rye, you name it, wheat or corn-based or a grass-based creates whiskey. Fruits create brandy. Brandy actually used to be the biggest spirits category in America until Prohibition knocked it out. But it's inherently a more expensive spirit. It costs much more to produce. I mean, think about what it takes to, you know, grow an apple tree and tend and care for that, or peach or grapes. In this case, it's inherently a more elegant, tasteful product that is beginning to come back as people are looking for alternatives, you know, because whiskey's been booming for a long time now and people are getting a little tired of it. And now the Armagnac region in France, here's a story. I mean, I was in France. I was doing a little sabbatical, a little travel when I realized I was selling Whistle Pig some years back, and I drove over to this region of France, and this guy whose family had been collectors of all the best different Armagnacs since the early 1900s was having some health issues and he wanted to sell. And in the whiskey world, you know, Whistle Pig is a 10-year age statement, which sounds, you know, old.
Right.
And I was traveling different places in the world, and this guy has every spirits vintage that goes back to 1868. So you have immediately post-Civil War, World War I, World War II, Gilded Age, Roaring Twenties, the Depression, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, all of these in different vintages. And I think, my God, you know, and the spirit is, it tastes amazing. And you have basically the story of human history in a bottle for the past 150 some odd years. It was enchanting, and that's what we have brought a good amount of over to Vermont. And that's what people will be able to taste in addition to some of the great whiskeys and rums that I also purchased in different parts of the world in my travels after I sold Whistlepig.
And this will be, they'll be able to taste it through, I think, something called the Stockholder Program. Am I right about that?
Yeah, Stockholder Program is very interesting. So this is, you know, people will be able to come in and taste just as a, let's say, you know, as a tourist or as a customer.
Sure.
The Stockholder Program, I'm glad you asked, but it's an interesting program that we put together as, these are people who are buying larger collections of really old spirits. And there are four pillars of the Bacta spirits, Bacta Armagnac brand. It's rare, it's exquisite, this is an asset, it goes up in value, and then it's true. And without getting too, I don't know, ethereal, the idea here on campus is to bring good ideas to life. Mm-hmm. And the Stockholder Program are basically people who are actually some very well-known people throughout America and different businesses that have bought these collections. And the purpose of this Stockholder Program, the club, are to bring these guys primarily together to help bring this campus to life. So not only are they investing and will presumably make money off of buying these great old bottles of spirits, which we'll appreciate, but they're also actively supporting the rebirth and revival of an entire, you know, campus and town.
Speaking of the town, how has the town of Pulteney reacted to the plans you have for the college?
You know, I look, the people in Pulteney are really lovely people. They're really nice people. And I've been, you know, welcomed with open arms in my first, you know, reaction really to the entire thing is, you know, boy, I had such a warm reaction. I was like, well, I can only go down from here. The, you know, there's a lot of expectation. Hopefully I won't disappoint, but the reception's been great. And I don't know, people don't always tell you to your face what they think. But insofar as people are being sincere, it's, you know, with a great deal of enthusiasm and hope, and I have no reason to expect that they're, you know, not sincere, because, you know, candidly, this could have turned into, you know, a ultra orthodox religious camp, which is not really much community engagement there, or, you know, kind of government housing, which is generally not very good for the local community. And what we have rather in its place is, you know, it's a continuation and rebirth as an educational institution, but I foresee actually creating, you know, no BS, the greatest destination resort in Vermont. And I think that'll produce a lot of growth, a lot of wealth, a lot of opportunity, and will hopefully have a ripple effect in this region of Vermont that really needs it.
Yeah. It was crushing for Green Mountain College alumni to see their school close, Raj. What have you heard from them, pro and con, about your plans for the property?
You know, I haven't heard the cons. You know, maybe they think that some businessman is going to come in and turn this into a, you know, some capitalist endeavor, and ain't that a shame? On the positive side, I think that there are a couple of Green Mountain alum who have set up offices for new businesses in the area here. I think that this is a beautiful place with a lot of great memories in it, and we're preserving that. So really what I mostly hear, the vast majority of is, you know, God bless, good luck, and, you know, those kinds of sentiments.
Yeah. I mentioned the Eagle Dome at the start, which is a lovely basketball gym. What will happen in there? Are you going to keep that?
You know what? That's one of the places that I'm not entirely sure what we're going to do with. For now, it remains. You know, I go in with my kids and the people in the company. We go and we shoot hoops. It's a beautiful space.
Yeah.
It's a little small. We were thinking of like an indoor riding arena for an equestrian center.
Sure.
There's not really anything that's you know, a really nice place to ride and keep your horses in this area. So we're batting around a couple of ideas, but the main anchors in terms of like the big buildings, if you recall, there are two big, beautiful buildings that sit out and look on the green. Those are going to be hotels. That is, you know, I would say the central focal point from a street facing standpoint. Those are going to get redone beautifully. And honestly, I think we'll have the nicest hotel experience available, not just in Vermont, but in New England, which will be a significant draw. In the library, which is another one of the big buildings, I'm a big lover of history and books, and we're going to dovetail all of the old books with the, you know, spirits collection. So to get an idea of how old things are, you want to taste a 1943 vintage, we'll have the books from that era in that section, so you really get a taste of just how old that is, or 1904. And whereas these are spirits that are aged longer and therefore taste better in most cases than any other spirits people have ever tasted in their lives.
Raj, we're going to have to leave it right there with that on our lips, thinking about it. Raj Bhakta is the founder of Bhakta Farms. He now owns the Green Mountain College campus in Pulteney. Raj, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Great to be here, Rick.
All right, take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. We've got Common Sense Radio up next with Bill Sayre. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we learn about Abreu Jewelry and we catch up with WDEV alum Jasper Goodman.